Category E5, sports broadcaster, Owen McDevitt.
You mentioned an incident in the book where you were essentially stopped by the army and asked to stand on the bridge, facing out from the bridge. Would you mind taking us through that?
Yeah, I was going with my wife, which was my wife at the time, Patricia, and I was coming back from visiting her, and it was a lovely summer's evening. It was near 11 o'clock. It was dark, but sort of a bright. There was enough light about, and there's a bridge outside Crossmead then called Craigan Bridge, about a mile and a half out of town, and I was stopped at the checkpoint there. I was on the car on my own, and they told me to park the car up along the side of the grass verge, which I did, and put me out of the car. And they do that normally, so I didn't think anything of it. But in this instance, they told me to sit on the wall on the bridge. Now the bridge, you know, there's a bit, maybe it's not that far, but it could be 15 or it could be 20 or 25 foot of a drop into water on rocks. And they put me sitting with my feet facing into the water, and they all seemed to vanish, and I asked them where they were, and they told me in no uncertain terms to shut me out and just be quiet. But the longer I sat there, which wasn't long, this might only have lasted for 5 or 6 minutes, but it seemed like a lifetime. But the things going through my head was, local footballer commits suicide, hops over. All he did was push me, and I was head first into this thing. But luckily enough, a second hand car dealer, a fella called Barney Evans, come choo-chooing in the road in an old banger. And I was never as glad to see anybody in all my life, and they told me to get off the wall, and this never happened.
Right.
So I met Barney a few nights later in a pub, and I bought him a few pints, and I told him how glad I was to see him coming in the road. And but it was just one of those things that happened, and it was scary now, because you didn't know what, you know what I mean. All they did do was push me with a finger, and I was straight down into rocks.
It's amazing, John, you talk about it now a long time later, and I suppose you've got a certain perspective on things, but for anyone listening to people having to go through that for no good reason, having to go through that, the fact that that actually was somewhat deemed normal at the time, and you say you were stopped the whole time, but for instance like that, for you to be afraid for your life like that, do you at that very moment, were you thinking, this isn't the way life is supposed to be?
Of course, you know, I mean, I was afraid that they'd do something and I'd be a goner. There's no way, if I had to go head first into rocks at that height, would I have survived. But thankfully it didn't happen. But those were the type of things that happened all the time, and I don't know whether the soldiers that did it knew I was involved in football or who I was or anything. It could be in anybody. But it was scary, very scary at the time.
How did people in Cross MacLean function from day to day with this sort of stuff going on around you?
I think eventually we become immune to them. They'd be walking up and down the street with their guns, and we'd be walking past them carrying on as normal as possible. You know, on match days, they'd be coming in with the helicopters. They'd be walking around the ground, and we just tried to act as if they weren't there and become immune to the whole thing. But it did put a resilience into the club that, you know, we're not going to lay down, we're not going to lose our pitch, and, you know, we could have lost it, and only for great work by great people in the club, government ministers, the late great Con Murphy from Cork, fought tirelessly for us. So there was a lot of things going on in the background, people helping and fighting for this. You know, a lot of politicians did things. There was a man in the club, Gene Larkin, and Gene Duffy from Crossmead, and Gene's still there now, a good friend of mine. And, you know, they were meeting all the time and fighting behind doors to make sure that we didn't lose our pitch.
Was there a bitterness, though, at the time? Would you have been bitter? Would you have had hate in your heart because you were being made to live in fear?
I wouldn't say there was a bitterness, but there was a resilience. I keep saying resilience because that's what it was. We're not gonna let this happen. We'll keep tugging out. And they were taking the Saracens. They had the Saracens in at that time, and the Saracens used to come up in and out in front of the ground, and you were walking through maybe a foot of muck, like these big trucks, and we had to clamber through that every day when you're going to training or going to matches before you went out onto the field. And the place was a total mess. But we were so lucky that we didn't lose the ground, and that was the most important thing that we held onto it.
It's funny, I don't know, do you get the sense that people from the south have ever fully understood how important football was to you in that context?
No, people in the south of Ireland didn't understand what was happening at all. If it happened down here, there would have been an uproar. But people in Northern Ireland just tried to get on with their lives, and it was tough. Like, when you're stopped every day, and I mean every day going to training or every day going to a match, you do get annoyed. The ball would be kicked from the field into the barracks, and it'd be thrown out with a hole in it. You know what I mean? Or maybe the ball not come back at all. Just the wee things that would annoy you and the big things you just get on with.
Yeah, and Gaelic football presumably then became more and more... For everyone, it's an enjoyable distraction, I guess, that's at the centre of all sport. But it was maybe more than that. Was it a part of expressing, or was it almost the entire identity of Cross McGlenn being able to play Gaelic football and actually compete?
We had nothing else. You know, we didn't have hurling, we didn't have soccer. Soccer didn't count to us. It was just Gaelic football. And the more boys that played the game, we sort of kept them off the streets. And the club did a massive amount of good work in keeping young lads off the street. It would have been very easy for a lot of young lads to say, here, we'll hop over to the other side here. But yeah, in fairness, the club environment and the guidance that we're getting, you know, kept a lot of boys on the straight and narrow. And it was great from that purpose too, to make sure that a lot of young lads kept off the street and didn't get involved.
How did you get from there into the athletics, into sprinting?
I didn't really, because there wasn't any. There was no such things as women showing bare legs. I mean, that was absolute total no-no in conservative Ireland of the 1940s and even right into the 50s. And people find this hard to believe. I played a lot of hockey, and we had to play hockey with long black stockings suspended to something around our middle, and covered by no flesh allowed to be seen, of course. In fact, before a hockey international, the team had to kneel down and have your skirt measured to make sure it was at least 4 inches. It was no more than 4 inches from the ground.
Wow.
People don't actually believe that, but that, I mean, that is a fact.
That's incredible. So somebody actually came in each time before an international.
Yes, Miss Russell, who was one of the head bombardiers in Irish hockey at the time. She's a super lady, a great woman from Cork, a marvellous sporting family. But her little job was to make sure that the girls' skirts were the right length.
So what was the reaction, if that was the sort of environment that you're talking about in Ireland of that time? What was there a lot of criticism, or were there people who had misgivings about you going over to the Olympic Games?
Certainly. I mean, I think almost everybody had misgivings except the people who knew me very well. This young woman, married only a couple of years with a small child, a baby daughter really, and here she was going off to the far side of the world to run. I mean, this is ridiculous. And there was a letter in the Irish Times which said so, that I was a disgrace to Irish womanhood, which I still have.
You still...
I thought it was... My parents thought it was the funniest thing they'd ever seen.
Really?
Yeah, they were... I mean, the family was very, very supportive. It was a, you know...
You must have been a very strong character, though, Maeve, because I suppose you can laugh at those letters now, and you said even at the time that your parents took it in a sort of light-hearted spirit, but some people wouldn't be able to handle those kind of comments.
No, that's quite true. I was very lucky. I was brought up in a very liberal family, and that was the way we were reared, and you were very hardy in that respect.
Maeve, you talked about the very strict dress code when you played international hockey for Ireland. Well, can I ask you, what were you wearing when you were in those Olympic Games on the track?
Oh, I had to go and get my own. It was absolutely brilliant. I was the only woman, so I was allowed to... I got a blazer, an Irish Olympic blazer, which I still have, which still fits me, I'm very proud to say. It has an odd moth hole in it, but it doesn't show, you know, in photographs and things. And I got a track suit. I used to call it my panda suit. It was a green track suit, and same as all the boys got. And I got a singlet, the same as all the boys got. And I was told to get my own shorts, so I got my own white shorts, the briefest I could find. And I had my own spikes. Adidas, funnily enough, supplied me with spikes and warm and training shoes, which was unheard of in those days. So, you know, I was okay. The vest, the singlet was a bit of a problem because it was made for boys, and boys' singlets were very low cut under the arms. And I thought, if I wear this, I'll be put in jail probably, because it wouldn't have covered any of me, you know.
Yeah.
And I had to get the needle and thread out and stitch it up. So that's okay. That was fine.
Maeve, when you were competing, when you were going over to Melbourne and also to Rome and Tokyo, were you very consciously trying to change the way that Irish people thought about women? Maybe that either how Irish women thought about themselves?
Was I a feminist, a woman libertine?
Yeah.
No, I wasn't. And as I said to you earlier, I came from a very liberal background where women were encouraged to do, in the family, were encouraged to do exactly what the men did. My family, my grandfather was Protestant Trinity, and I grew up partly in Trinity. The whole attitude of the family was, you must learn everything you can, you must try anything you have the opportunity to try. The world is a big place, and we're only a very tiny part of it. And they were all very, very good Christian families. I mean, on both sides of my family, they were marvellous people, wonderful people.
Joe, you personally now have helped the team to two Heineken Cups since you arrived as head coach. You've been receiving praise from all around Europe, really, former players, other coaches, people in the media. Is that something that you take cognizance of, that the esteem that you're now held in world rugby, given that you have mentioned before that you were maybe somewhat reluctant to take on a head coaching role?
Yeah, okay. I'm a little bit sort of taken aback. It is flattering to particularly have people in the sport and people who write well in the sport who know it to say that you might know what you're doing. But I think any coach, you know, even after yesterday, you can't help questioning yourself. Did I make the right subs at the right time? Did I try to give the right solutions? Could we have done something different toward the end of the game to try to kind of maybe stonewall the game and slow it down? You know, I think inevitably you can't help but question yourself. I think if you don't, to be honest, then that's when complacency might set in. That's when, if you think that you believe everything that that might be written, I think that's when you might miss the boat.
All right, Joe, can I ask you lastly, everything is still raw, but victory and defeat over the last week or so, when do you actually get to switch off and maybe head off on a nice holiday?
I'll work through this week and get everything tidied up. It's a pretty exciting time even for us now. We're moving into a new facility, a new CD. It's a fantastic looking facility. So even that, in preparation for next year, gives you a little bit of a spring in your step. And then I'll get 3 weeks where I'll head back to New Zealand to see family and friends. Maybe I'll take in the first test in Auckland. And the rest of the family will join up post my daughter's leaving cert exams, and we'll have 3 or 4 days together. Then I'll shoot back for pre-season, and they'll stay on for a little bit longer. And then I think they're heading to France for a couple of weeks, and they'll join me back here in I suppose late July.
All right. One of the issues, Martin, that looms over this Formula One season is the fourth race in the schedule, which is in Bahrain towards the end of April. What's your stance on whether or not this should actually take place this year? Because it was cancelled last year in the aftermath of the clashes between the protesters and the ruling family, and it seems like still quite unresolved over there. Do you think, are you uneasy about it?
If Formula One happens in Bahrain, I will very much be there and doing my job and supporting the Grand Prix. I've been to Bahrain 10 times. I like the place and I know the people. And I've got friends there, I've got people who've got businesses there. I also read extensively what we have in the media. I find it very difficult to marry the two up from what I hear when I speak to people who are living there. And it is difficult to understand, you know, the gravity of the situation there and what the truth is. And I think we have to trust the FIA, who run Formula One, and the teams and the governments, and if the government is saying you can't travel to that country, then the Grand Prix won't happen because nobody's got insurance and it wouldn't be wise to go against that advice. But right now everybody's saying, not everybody, but many are saying, we think this should go ahead. And speaking to my friends and colleagues there, I it sounds to me like the right decision, but I'm sure it's being monitored daily.
Yeah, because we were speaking about this last month, and we're going to actually play a clip here. Ed Gorman is deputy editor of the London Times, wrote in Formula One for a long time. He was speaking to us, as was Nabil Rajab, who is president of the Bahrain Centre for Human Rights and a protester over there. So just play a clip and see what you think.
The great majority of Bahraini cannot offer to go there because it's expensive. But the Bahraini government tried to tell the international community everything is back to normal in Bahrain. By having the Formula One racing in Bahrain, they tried to tell the international community everything back to normal, where everything is not back to normal. We have still people dying on a weekly basis. We've been, on an hourly basis, people being arrested, systematically tortured, attacked, wounded, injured, houses being raided, checkpoints. People are humiliated. And the Bahrain government, at the same time, internationally tried to employ PR companies and having inviting Formula One and others to show Bahrain is back to business, where it is not, and we don't want it. We don't want the regime to mislead the public opinion in this regard.
Bernie Eccleston, who runs the sport, has always been. He always likes to think that he can do whatever he wants, and he doesn't need to think about the realities of politics or even the economy in some of the countries that he's taken Formula One to. Formula One shouldn't go anywhere near Bahrain. Bahrain is a completely unresolved issue. It's a bitter sectarian conflict. There is incredible hatred between both sides. The abuses committed by the government have been, as you've just heard in your previous interview, they've been extensive, varied and shocking.
What do you make of what you've heard there, Martin?
Well, I come back to it. There are lots of different points of view and agendas, and I think that it is difficult to marry up the different points of view that you get. As I said, you know, I speak to people who are living there.
Nabil Rajab lives there, and he describes the conditions in the country, and it doesn't seem like, for a start, a stable enough place to go. And as we hear there also from Ed Gorman, it's unresolved. But Nabil Rajab lives the reality of it, and he doesn't feel that the majority of the country want it there.
I know a lot of other people who are desperate for business to get up and running there again, and you know, for life to return to normal, and obviously the Formula One is a key part of that. I mean, if we go there and there's trouble, I'm sure we'll be out of there in a hurry. But I think the important thing is that Formula One mustn't be used as a political device, if you like, as a crowbar to achieve things. But you know, it can do good, and it I can't see that Formula One can do harm necessarily there. But I think
the harm it could do is that it's maybe legitimizing what's going on. It's, as we hear there from Nabil, he feels that the authorities there have this great shiny lovely spectacle, and everyone thinks, oh, Bahrain is a great country, there are no problems there, and that's not really what the common Bahraini person wants the rest of the world to feel.
That may be the case, and there are two opinions you've just expressed there with playing those two pieces in, and you know, I've spoken to other people with different opinions.
News Talk 106 to 108.